This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
Once upon a time in a certain kingdom lived a poor miller who had a very beautiful daughter.
Fairy tales can come true. It can happen to you.
Have they ever come true for you? You might not want them to. Today we'll hear about fairy tales old.
Well, there are core elements that have to happen in a Nutcracker if it's at all traditional.
And new.
Everyone deserves a chance to fly.
My guest is Gregory Maguire, who wrote the original novel on which the Broadway smash Wicked is based. And I'll talk to the writer and director Stephen Gagan about his new movie Syriana. That is all ahead in Studio 360 right after this.
PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. No matter how modern and cynical and technologically savvy we get, Americans love fairy tales. Our daughters still dress up as princesses and fairies on Halloween. The wedding notices in the newspaper love to talk about fairy tale endings. And Hollywood still churns out movies of magic and danger and plucky heroes, from this year's film about the Brothers Grimm to Disney's new Chronicles of Narnia, which were among my children's favorite books when they were small.
It's a beaver.
Yeah, boy.
I ain't gonna smell it, if that's what you want.
It's a talking beaver.
And if you're in New York City for the holidays, you might be trying to score a ticket for Wicked, one of the biggest blockbusters on Broadway. It is a biography of America's most famous witch and how she got that way.
Once I'm with the wizard, my whole life will change. 'Cause once you're with the wizard, no one thinks you're strange.
Gregory Maguire wrote the novel Wicked, as well as a new sequel called Son of a Witch. He has also turned classic tales like Cinderella and Sleeping Beauty on their heads, and his own life story has something of a fairy tale quality to it as well. Gregory Maguire, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, how and why did you start reimagining the life of the Wicked Witch of the West?
I was living in England during the first Gulf War, and I began to ask myself questions about how the press was dealing with Saddam Hussein, how they were picturing him and painting him in a way to make morally legitimate the military action about to be taken against him. And I thought, I think I should know more about how we legitimize the people we disagree with as villains. I decided at first, since the only way that I know how to think about anything is as a novelist, that I would write a novel about Hitler, find out what made him so evil, find out why his very name was still so scary to me as an adult. Very soon I discovered I wasn't smart enough to write about Hitler. So I went back and thought, well, who else can I write about that is commonly perceived to be a great villain? I flicked through my mental Rolodex, and I came up with Margaret Hamilton as pictured in the 1939 film, saying, "I'll get you and little dog." I had been terrified by that as a child. I was terrified still. So my story began as an exercise to find out how she became so evil.
Well, so you start out to write the novel and you want to explore, inspired by Saddam Hussein and Hitler, I guess, the nature of evil. And then you turn the Wicked Witch into a kind of victimized, free-spirited left-winger. How did that process happen?
It's like the process that by which any parent grows to love his or her new child. I really did intend to write the biography of a villain, of a morally heinous, corrupt individual, like a Hannibal Lecter story. But even though my green-skinned baby, born with sharp teeth and apparently amoral, was intended to grow up to be a terrible villainess, by the time I reached page 25, every time she came onto the page, I would say, "Oh, isn't she cute?" I began to like her despite myself, despite my own aesthetic ambitions. And I began to understand that it wouldn't be easy being green, and it wouldn't be easy growing up in a world in which not only was she the wrong color, she was the only one of that color.
Well, let's hear a little bit from the musical, a song with Idina Menzel as Elphaba, the Wicked Witch, trying to convince Kristen Chenoweth as Glinda the Good Witch to join forces with her.
Unlimited, together we're unlimited. Together we'll be the greatest team there's ever been. Glinda dreams the way we plan them. If we work in tandem, there's no fight we
That's the cast of the hit Broadway musical Wicked. The author of the novel on which the musical was based is Gregory Maguire, and he's here with me today to talk about fairy tales of various kinds. Gregory, as a kid, were you interested in or devoted to a particular fairy tale?
My parents were very strict. This was due to a sort of fairy tale accident of my own upbringing. My mother died in childbirth. How's that for a fairy tale? That only happens in fairy tales, apparently, except it happened to me. So I lived with relatives and then in an orphanage until my father, whose health was poor, got better and was able to take his children back and marry again a wonderful woman, my stepmother, who raised me. That's a fairy tale beginning. Perhaps because of that beginning, when I read the fairy tales, almost all of which start with a mother dying and leaving a bereft child alone in the dangerous world, well, those stories spoke to me very deeply. I don't know at the time when I was 12 that I recognized how deeply they were speaking, but of course they seemed to, didn't they? Because by the time I got old enough to write novels of my own, I wanted to write about those children who were abandoned in a treacherous landscape.
As a fairy tale fan and fairy tale rewriter, are you strict about what makes a fairy tale, about the definition, or are you liberal in that regard?
I'd say that I'm fairly liberal. There is something about the fairy tale that I think suggests a cast of mind that is gratifyingly pre-Freudian. Mm-hmm. Before we needed the language that said all of our conflicts were always going to be internal, we had a different code, we had a different set of terms by which to talk about the stresses in life. Sometimes they were religious terms, sometimes they were terms having to do with the spirits in the fairy world, or let's say the world of the ancestors. I like those terms. They seem to me both metaphoric and mysterious.
And whether it's a folk tale or a nature myth or a story or a legend, as long as magical things happen, you're willing to call it a fairy tale, I guess.
Well, even maybe it doesn't have to be magical things happen, but as long as the world can be perceived as a place where magical things might happen. My book, Confessions of an Ugly Stepsister, is a fairy tale in a sense, but it's written as a sort of a historical novel. It's set in the 17th century in Holland, and not a single magic thing ever happens in that story, but the young protagonist is a child filled with magic in her head, and she sees what's going on as possibly being evidence of sprites and demons and magical aids and abettors, and that's fairy tale enough for me.
My guest today is the author of Wicked, Gregory Maguire, and we're talking about the durability and the constant reinvention of fairy tales. Now, we would be remiss if we didn't actually give you a fairy tale. So we asked the actress Tanya Pinkins to tell the one about the miller's daughter who makes a bargain she doesn't want to keep.
Once upon a time in a certain kingdom lived a poor miller who had a very beautiful daughter. She was moreover exceedingly shrewd and clever. And the miller was so vain and proud of her that he one day told the king of the land that his daughter could spin gold out of straw. Now this king was very fond of money, and when he heard the miller's boast, his avarice was excited, and he ordered the girl to be brought before him. Then he led her to a chamber where there was a great quantity of straw, gave her a spinning wheel, and said, "All this must be spun into gold before morning, as you value your life." It was in vain that the poor maiden declared that she could do no such thing. The chamber was locked and she remained alone. She sat down in one corner of the room and began to lament over her hard fate, when on a sudden the door opened and a droll-looking little man hobbled in and said, "Good morrow to you, my lass. What are you weeping for?" "Alas," answered she, "I must spin this straw into gold, and I know not how." "What will you give me," said the little man, "to do it for you?" "My necklace," replied the maiden. He took her at her word and set himself down to the wheel. Round about it went merrily, and presently the work was done and the gold all spun. When the king came and saw this, he was greatly astonished and pleased.
But his heart grew still more greedy of gain, and he shut up the poor miller's daughter again with a fresh task. Then she knew not what to do, and sat down once more to weep. But the little man presently opened the door and said, "What will you give me to do your task?" "The ring on my finger," replied she. So her little friend took the ring and began to work at the wheel, till by morning all was finished again. The king was vastly delighted to see all this glittering treasure, but still he was not satisfied, and took the miller's daughter into a yet larger room and said, "All this must be spun tonight, and if you succeed, you shall be my queen." As soon as she was alone, the dwarf came in and said, "What will you give me to spin gold for you this third time?" "I have nothing left," said she. "Then promise me," said the little man, "your first little child when you are queen." "That may never be," thought the miller's daughter, and as she knew no other way to get her task done, she promised him what he had asked, and he spun once more the whole heap of gold. The king came in the morning, and finding all he wanted, married her, and so the miller's daughter really became queen.
Later, we'll hear what happens when that cranky gnome comes to claim the queen's firstborn child. The Tale of Rumpelstiltskin, to be continued in a minute here in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International.
Studio 360 is brought to you in part by Nonesuch Records, presenting the new 2-CD set from Wilco, Kicking Television, featuring 23 tracks recorded live in Chicago, available at tower.com/nonesuch.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Today, with the writer Gregory Maguire, we're talking about fairy tales. But now, back to Tanya Pinkins and the story of Rumpelstiltskin. In the last chapter we heard, the miller's daughter had become queen after promising her firstborn child to the gnome, who had magically helped her perform her impossible task.
At the birth of her first little child, the queen rejoiced very much and forgot the little man and her promise. But one day he came into her chamber and reminded her of it. Then she grieved sorely at her misfortune and offered him all the treasures of the kingdom in exchange, but in vain, till at last her tears softened him, and he said, "I will give you 3 days' grace, and if during that time you tell me my name, you shall keep your child." Now the queen lay awake all night, thinking of all the odd names that she had ever heard, and dispatched messengers all over the land to inquire after new ones. The next day the little man came, and she began with Timothy, Benjamin, Jeremiah, and all the names she could remember, but to all of them he said, "That's not my name." The second day she began with all the comical names she could hear of, Bundy Legs, Hunchback, Crookshanks, and so on. But the little gentleman still said to every one of them, "That's not my name." The third day came back one of the messengers and said, "I can hear of no other name, but yesterday, as I was climbing a high hill among the trees of the forest where the fox and the hare bid each other good night, I saw a little hut, and before the hut burnt a fire, and round about the fire danced a funny little man upon one leg and sung, Merrily the feast I'll make, today I'll brew, tomorrow bake, merrily I'll dance and sing, for next day will a stranger bring. Little does my lady dream, Rumpelstiltskin is my name. When the queen heard this, she jumped for joy, and as soon as her little visitor came and said, Now, lady, what is my name? Is it John? Asked she. No. Is it Tom? No. Can your name be Rumpelstiltskin? Some witch told you that. Some witch told you that, cried the little man, and dashed his right foot in a rage so deep into the floor that he was forced to lay hold of it with both his hands to pull it out. Then he made the best of his way off, while everybody laughed at him for having had all his trouble for nothing.
Fairy tale purists, take note. In the version of that story I remember from childhood, at the end, they don't laugh at him. Rumpelstiltskin tries so hard to pull his leg out of the floor that he rips himself in half. Now that is an old school fairy tale ending. That was Tanya Pinkins reading the Brothers Grimm version as translated into English in 1823. Tanya appears in John Turturro's new movie Romance and Cigarettes, which is due out in 2006. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today with the novelist Gregory Maguire, and we're talking about fairy tales. Over the last week since Thanksgiving, you might have noticed strange appearances by 8-foot-tall wooden soldiers in some kind of Napoleonic getup. I just saw a platoon of them in a bank. Dance scholar Jennifer Fisher wrote a book about the incredible nutcracker craze in America, and it turns out to be a stranger story than you might think. She and some students from the Ballet Academy East tell us how a scary tale from a German Gothic author found its way into our 21st century hearts and minds.
Well, there are core elements that have to happen in a nutcracker if it's at all traditional. A carved nutcracker doll must be given to a girl named Clara, or sometimes Marie, at a Christmas party.
Okay, so Mary Putnam, they have a party, and people all over the world come, and she gets a nutcracker, and she cracks nuts, and she gives it to everyone but her brother, and he breaks it. And
oh, yeah, I have an annoying brother.
I have a really annoying brother.
And that's when the tree begins to grow and everything, and she goes into her semi-dreamy world.
The doll must come to life at midnight in a fantasy scene.
And then her brother comes out as a nutcracker. Then the mice come, and there's like a battle between the mice and the soldiers.
And then a magical sleigh comes, and they get taken to Central Park, where there are all these snow skaters.
Different communities feel free to adapt it. They set it in their own hometown, so each one has its own atmosphere.
My favorite part is Sugar Plum Fairy, because she...
What?
She dances. Yeah.
And after that, the story really is that a lot of people perform dances for Clara. And then sometimes at the end of the ballet, she ends up waking up in her own bed. That's an innovation in North America, really, that reminds me of The Wizard of Oz, the fact that it's all been a dream. The Nutcracker was a commissioned ballet during the golden age of classical dancing in St. Petersburg at the end of the 19th century. And they had a huge ballet factory back then. They tell Tchaikovsky, give me 18 bars of music for this and give me 12 bars here. Petipa, the famous choreographer, he gets sick, so Ivanov, a Russian choreographer, takes over. They rehearse, they have the best dancers in the world, and that was 1892 when it first appeared in Russia.
I think that probably the Nutcracker was, in my opinion, the best ballet I've ever seen.
It got mixed reviews. They weren't all negative, but nobody really appreciated it for what it was.
And like many immigrants, it just starts traveling throughout the world. The ballet ends up being done in bits and parts, and then suddenly someone in North America, in San Francisco, Willem Christensen, stages the whole ballet for the first time. And then 10 years later, in 1954, Balanchine, a Russian immigrant himself, takes over and makes his version of the Nutcracker.
Christmas goes with Nutcracker. If you don't have one, you can't really have the other.
He saw immediately that Americans loved Christmas, and he added a few touches, like a reindeer, tons of snow, and a lot of family feeling to it. And in New York, he saw immediately that this could be part of the Christmas season. And it was opportunistic, but it was also a beautiful classical ballet. He could combine those two things. Gradually, people left the City Ballet in New York and traveled, or artistic directors and dancers would come to New York and see it. And it was on television in 1957 and 58. And I think it was in the right place at the right time.
I think my family reserves half the tickets in the theater.
My cousin, my babysitter, and some of my
mom, my dad, my brother, and my grandparents.
So basically, everybody that we know is coming.
The Nutcracker has long been denigrated as a cash cow, a necessary evil. And I think the dance community puts down the Nutcracker at its peril because it needs to notice the very real work that the Nutcracker is doing to make bridges between what is often perceived as a high art community. And they're always wondering, how do we get more people to pay attention to this very expensive elite art form? The Nutcracker does it every year.
Jennifer Fisher is the author of Nutcracker Nation. Curtis Fox produced our story. I'm here today with Gregory McGuire, who wrote the novel Wicked, and we're talking about fairy tales. That was just lovely, hearing those children's darling, innocent voices. But it's strange to realize that the Nutcracker was originally by a horror writer, E.T.A. Hoffmann, who was basically the German Stephen King of his time, and it has been transformed.
It's been coated with caster sugar. But why not? A good story can be told many times in different tones and modalities and still retain its essence. You know what I really liked about that segment you just played was how the little girl said, what you need is you have to have skaters in Central Park. You know, what they really meant is a story can be boiled down to its very few irreducible elements. And as long as you know which are the identifying elements of a classic tale, you can then tell that tale any way you want. In Snow White, for instance, I think any story that has a dwarf, a mirror, and an apple in it is by its nature a Snow White story. You can cast it in any key. You can tell it like Hoffman might as a horror meister, as you say, or you can tell it as Balanchine might have done, but it's still the same story.
Why do you suppose it is that so much of our fairy tale canon comes from a fairly small stretch of Northern Europe and in a fairly small period of the 19th century?
Well, it has a lot to do with the fact that the Brothers Grimm, in collecting the tales, were less interested really in the tales at first than they were in trying to understand both how language developed and in understanding how people migrated around that part of Germany. The popularity of the tales was a sort of side effect of some of their concerns. But once the tales became published first in German and then in English, I think about 12 years later, other scholars went rushing to see where the treasure troves of peasant tales might be before they disappeared.
Uh-huh. So the vestiges of medieval tale era was still living practically at that point.
They were scarcely a stone's throw from the modern universities. You could go out to get a drink from your local farm and find that there was some old granny in the Inglenook who remembered stories that her great-granny had told, and they hadn't changed all that much over 500 or 600 years, one assumes.
It's interesting in the ways that we, in certainly in North America, celebrate Christmas with the Nutcracker and the story of Santa Claus and the Grinch. All of it has very little to do with the gospel story of the birth of Jesus. It's all about celebrating Christmas.
Well, I often say that one of the reasons that the old fairy tales are so popular is that they are so portable. And indeed, I do sometimes liken them to the parables of the gospels. That is to say, not that they impart little gems of information about how one ought to behave, but because they're so small, it doesn't take a whole lot of brain power in order to be able to remember them. That's what parables were for. They were instant lessons that one could think of and act on immediately. And the fairy tales are another kind of instant lesson. Look, it's not the Odyssey that people are traipsing around trying to carry and retell. It's a story about getting lost in the woods and making sure not to talk to strangers. They're simple stories, but boy, are they portable, and that's why they've lasted.
Gregory Maguire, novelist and fairy tale buff, is my guest today. If you haven't read Salman Rushdie's novels, you probably know about him for one odd and terrifying part of his life story. In 1989, the Ayatollah Khomeini declared that Rushdie's novel Satanic Verses was heresy against Islam and issued his infamous fatwa, essentially marking the writer for assassination. Rushdie lived in hiding for years until long after the Ayatollah's death. Jonathan Mitchell has the story of how this horrible episode ended up with sort of a silver lining.
When Salman Rushdie was living in hiding under the threat of death, one might have expected him to write a dark, bitter retaliation. What he actually wrote was a comic surrealist fairy tale. But then the conditions under which he was living were pretty surreal. The whole way he lived had to be completely reinvented. He wasn't even able to spend time with his young son. But one way Rushdie found that he could reach out to his son was through his writing. So during that time, he wrote a fairy tale called Harun in the Sea of Stories.
There was once in the country of Aleph Bay a sad city, the saddest of cities, a city so ruinously sad that it had forgotten its name. It stood by a mournful sea full of glumfish, which were so miserable to eat that they made people belch with melancholy, even though the skies were blue.
It's about a young boy named Harun, whose father loses his storytelling powers after his marriage breaks up. The story is full of colorful characters and imaginative locations. It's just the kind of story that would make a good opera.
Opera is, after all, if you remember Samuel Johnson's definition of it, an irrational entertainment.
Charles Warnin composed the music for a new opera based on Rushdie's book.
And a book like this, where the events that take place, while they are humanly grounded in a very profound way, nevertheless they are also magical, is just the sort of thing that I thought, and I think I'm right, can work very nicely on the stage.
A modernist composer with a background in 12-tone surrealism may seem like an odd pairing with a fantasy story like this. It was Warnin himself who initiated the project.
I wrote it just as a piece setting this text the way I usually do, without all kinds of conscious designs on addressing it to a particular group. Because of the nature of the libretto and because of the humor and the fantasy in it, it's bound to appeal to children, and so it does.
The libretto is full of clever puns and comic turns, and it's a light-handed approach to what was, for Salman Rushdie, a very serious matter.
There's no doubt that Salman is dealing with the issue of free speech and freedom of the imagination.
James Fenton wrote the opera's libretto.
The forces of evil are attacking the source of all stories. The representative of this world of evil objects on principle to stories because they represent a world which he can't control, which is the world of the imagination.
Foolish child, the world is not for fun. The world is for controlling. Inside every single story is a story world that I cannot rule at all. Beyond my control, can you imagine it? Can you
In the opera, as in the book, Haroon eventually saves the day and restores his father's ability to write. It's a modern-day fairy tale, one in which it's not a princess that needs to be saved, but free speech. In 1991, while he was still in hiding, Rushdie made a rare public appearance at Columbia University.
Obviously, a rigid, blinkered, absolutist worldview is the easiest type to keep hold of, whereas the fluid, uncertain, metamorphic picture I've always carried about is rather more vulnerable. Yet I must cling with all my might to that chameleon, that chimera, that shapeshifter, my own soul.
Charles Warnin.
I think that especially the more people complain, the more people worry, the more necessary it is to have affirmation of life, affirmation of the imagination, affirmation of fantasy and all of these things. And I think that kind of thing is a good in itself.
Free speech is a non-starter, says one of my Islamic extremist opponents. No, sir, it is not. Free speech is the whole thing, the whole ball game. Free speech is life itself.
For Studio 360, I'm Jonathan Mitchell.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and I'm talking today with the novelist Gregory Maguire. Gregory, have you read Salman Rushdie's children's book, Haroon and the Sea of Stories?
I have, some years ago, but I remember it quite well, actually. I didn't know about the opera, and I'm glad to learn about it.
His story, his real-life story, is so remarkable, and I can't imagine, I don't know of any other like it. So he's not repressed in his own country by a hostile government, but living comfortably in Britain and suddenly, almost like a spell by an evil vizier, he's forced into hiding. I mean, it really does have the shape and substance of a fairy tale.
Well, the darker kind of fairy tale, it does indeed. You know what it reminds me of? There's a quote by the translator from the Danish of the Andersen fairy tales, Erik Christian Hogard. He said, "The fairy tale belongs to the poor. A fascist fairy tale is an absurdity. I know of no tale that takes the side of the tyrant against the disenfranchised." That's what Rushdie's saying, that being disenfranchised is indeed the place where you walk in a story. If you're disenfranchised, in a sense, you are the hero of the tale because you have a road to travel.
And I suppose if life seems hopeless, magical thinking is a natural course of, if not action, of thought.
Well, it's a therapy, if nothing else.
You experienced your book being turned into musical theater, though not with challenging 12-tone music. Was it a revelation for you to see it transformed musically?
In a sense, I have always known that my characters could sing. When I write a novel, I know that they can sing. When I was doing a book tour for Wicked, the novelist Alice Hoffman gave me a puppet of the Wicked Witch of the West and said, "Take this as your chaperone." I used to put her on a bottle of water at the podium, and then I used to sing to my audiences about the fact that the story of Oz is not all over the rainbow and trouble melting away like lemon drops on the chimney tops. I used to sing, "Somewhere over the rainbow, she's there too," meaning the Wicked Witch, "and the dreams that you're scared to dream really do come true." That's what happened to Dorothy.
You've
what
got a future in show tunes, Gregory Maguire.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I'm waiting. The phones are open. The lines are open for anybody who wants to book me.
Does it concern you, as some critics say sometime, that children's stories have become too consistently kind of goody-goody instructional stories these days?
What has happened in the middle part of the 20th century, I think, is this saccharine coating on tales. Disney was responsible for some of it, but there's a great deal of gloom and darkness in Disney as well. I think we've come out the other side of that. I think now our stories for children have gone back to reflecting a fuller picture of what the world is like. But beyond that, remember, the fairy tales were not told originally to children. They were told to the whole family, and children just happened to be sitting at the edge of the firelight listening. They were only turned into children's stories in the 19th century once they were collected and put into print. Then they got immediately shunted upstairs to the nursery, and adults kind of forgot about them.
Adults may have consciously forgotten about them, but isn't it fair to say that we all still inhabit a world governed by the fairy tales of our childhoods?
You're exactly right. And you know what you're putting your finger on? The fact is that the fairy tales comprise one of the few sets of universal references that we have here in this country. It doesn't matter what side of the tracks you're born on. It doesn't matter whether you're from a red state or a blue state. If you've reached a certain point, that is by about 4.5, then to say a pumpkin coach means basically the same thing in every parlor on every street corner. Everybody knows Cinderella. Everybody knows Snow White. You don't have to believe something. You don't have to have come from somewhere. You don't even have to have come from this country in order for that to be part of your common language.
Gregory Maguire, thank you very much. It has been great talking to you.
Well, it's been my pleasure, and the best wishes of the holiday season to you.
Gregory Maguire has been my guest today. He is the author of the novel Wicked and its new sequel, Son of a Witch. You can find out more about him at studio360.org. Coming up, big oil, corruption, terror, and the CIA.
If anything happens to me or my family, an accident, an accusation, anything, then first your son will disappear. His body will never be found. Then your wife, her body will never be found either. Now, this is guaranteed.
The writer and film director Stephen Gagan joins me to talk about his new movie, Syriana. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is brought to you in part by Nonesuch Records, presenting the new 2-CD set from Wilco, Kicking Television, featuring 23 tracks recorded live in Chicago, available at tower.com/nonesuch.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. The movie Syriana opens around the country next week, and at first glance, it might look like a flashy political thriller aimed to draw in moviegoers with sheer star power. Its cast includes George Clooney and Matt Damon. But what will stick with audiences is its provocative and disturbing plot, an intricate tale about the oil industry and the CIA and the Middle East. In this scene, Matt Damon plays an oil broker who is advising a Persian Gulf prince.
But why would you need an economic advisor? 20 years ago, you had the highest GNP in the world. Today, you're tied with Albania. So, good work. Your second biggest export is secondhand goods, followed closely by dates, for which you lose 5 cents a pound. You want to know what the business world thinks of you? We think 100 years ago, you were living out here in tents in the desert, chopping each other's heads off, and that's exactly where you're going to be in another 100.
So now you're my economic advisor. Why don't you tell me something I don't already know?
Syriana's writer and director Stephen Gagan is here with me today. Gagan's script for the 2001 film Traffic was a similarly tangled story about the vast system of the illegal drug trade. That one won him an Academy Award. Stephen Gagan, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you, Kurt. It's great to be here.
Now, the name, Syriana, it's never clearly explained in the film why the movie's called Syriana.
I wanted Syriana to stand for something that seems to be going on in us, in humans, and it's been going on in the West for a long time, which is our belief that we can remake the East to suit our own purposes. And I came to think of that under the rubric of Syriana, rather than, say, a specific nation-state that could have been made out of Iran, Iraq, and Syria.
Now, the movie is based partly on a nonfiction book by a former CIA agent named Bob Baer. You worked with Baer closely on the script. Do you feel the film shows a real CIA insider's view of the world today?
You know, I spent about 18 months researching, and I interviewed really hundreds of people. And I met men in Washington, I met men in the Middle East, men in Europe, and they would be absolutely certain, and they'd have these often ideologically motivated speeches they would give. They were quite convincing. And you'd hear someone who seems like they have the whole picture, and they convince you. An hour later, you hear someone who shows you really, you know, that they don't have the whole picture. They actually just have a small part of it. And in fact, they might actually be confused. So I wanted the film really to mirror what I was feeling, the way the world felt to me. You know, when I tried to process the news, how did I feel? And quite often I felt a little, you know, I felt a little beaten down. And I wanted to get that.
So a lot of what happens in the film is deliberately pretty murky, but I came away with two clear points. One, the CIA assassinates the progressive heir to this oil kingdom, which is a pretty disturbing depiction of American policy. And then two Muslim kids suicide bomb an American oil rig. I wondered if, on that second point, anybody has accused you of trying to justify terrorism.
Well, I hope the terrorists don't seem justified in their act, because I'm in no way trying to say that. And that's very important. I feel like in the wake of 9/11, you know, I heard this language like we're on a crusade, that, you know, we've got an axis of evil, that they're evildoers. You know, we go into Afghanistan, we go into Iraq. You know, regardless of where you stand on this, from the right or the left, pro or con, these are precipitous changes. You know, 50 years of bilateral maintenance of the status quo in the Middle East is going away. It's happening. It did happen. And now we're engaged in this democracy exportation project. We're in it. You know, it's our government doing it on our behalf. If you're an American riding along in the back seat of the car, you felt that car accelerate and you felt it turn. I think everybody has to be asking, you know, where is it going? What is exactly happening? I think those are very important questions to ask. Someone posed this question to Bob Baer and myself, you know, the ex-CIA officer, the real one, and they said, you know, do you really expect us to believe this? And Bob said, wake up. He's like, we pulled the trigger in Langley, went through Tampa, remote-controlled drone, launched a missile, and took out four guys in a car. He goes, do you think that's an assassination? Do you think that's an act of political assassination? He goes, because I'm sitting here telling you, it is. That's what it is. You did it. America did it. Wake up. How do you feel about it? Do you know who was in that car? Do you know, you know, their background? Do you know what they were really doing? He goes, because I don't, and I've tried to find out. And this is the question I was asking as I was writing Syriana. Are we a country, you know, that's still wearing the white hat? Because my identity growing up as like a all-American pot-smoking soccer player from Kentucky was that I wear the white hat.
My youth as a filmgoer corresponded to the age of the paranoid political thriller, Parallax View.
I was obsessed with Parallax View. Also, 3 Days of the Condor.
Yeah.
You know, and what was interesting to me about Parallax View and Condor specifically is that at the end, they basically in the last 5 minutes, in both of them, a character turns up to say, more or less, it's the military-industrial complex. It's big oil. You know, and you go, ah, big oil. You know, at the end of Condor, it's Robert Redford on the steps of the New York Times. And he's got a box, and he's heading in there, all hopefully, because they're going to save the day. And the guy says, this is big oil, pal. You think these guys are going to listen? And then we'd fade out. And I thought in the intervening 30 years, what's so interesting is that that's not the punchline to a conspiracy anymore. It's too out in the open.
Too simple.
The framework has shifted. Everybody knows the influence of big oil. I sort of thought, all right, it's big oil. Fade in. Now what? It was a question that it completely, you know, consumed me. I wanted to have the press save the day. I really did. I really believe in the press. Unfortunately, I didn't see a press that I thought I could turn it over to at the end of this movie in any convincing way. You know, think about Bob Woodward. 1975, he's bringing down the Nixon administration with his Watergate investigation. 30 years later, okay, he's a guy who gets these multi-million-dollar, you know, for right or wrong, multi-million-dollar advances on books that are predicated on his access to the Bush White House, his insider access to this White House, and he's having to apologize to his editors for essentially lying by omission. Think about Woodward in 75, Woodward in 2005. You know, this is directly related to the type of thriller, you know, that America can get.
We're all embedded now, I guess.
You know, you said it.
Steve Gagan, thanks very much for coming into Studio 360.
Thank you, Kurt.
Stephen Gagan is the writer and director of Syriana. It opens nationwide next weekend. In a couple of weeks, Ludwig van Beethoven, if he were alive, would have turned 235. There have been many, many biographies of the composer written since the 19th century. This year, Edmund Morris, the celebrated biographer of American presidents, wrote his own short life of Beethoven. Morris won the Pulitzer Prize for one of his books about Teddy Roosevelt, and he's also the author of Dutch about Ronald Reagan. I talked to Morris about how this particular composer captured his imagination. So you were born in what was then the British Empire in Africa. Under what circumstances did you first hear Beethoven?
It was through the earphones of my crystal set. I don't know if that word still means anything, but my little amateur radio set, which caught the overseas service of the BBC. And I remember hearing one night, beneath this pyramid of bedclothes, the sounds of the Beethoven Eroica Symphony coming through my earphones, going in and out of volume. Not exactly the dynamics Beethoven intended, but it sounded marvelous to me.
How old were you?
I guess I was about 10. Here was the sound of the early 19th century. Here's the sound of Europe. Here's the sound of a genius. It was completely transforming.
Did you have, in the course of the research and writing the book, insights into who he was, how he lived, either factual or conceptual, that hadn't been covered in the previous biographies?
I have emphasized more than most writers the suddenness with which his genius exploded in his 19th year. It's generally assumed that Beethoven only began to write great music when he got to Vienna a couple of years later.
From Bonn?
Yes, from Bonn. He grew up in Bonn, thank you. But there was a particular cantata that he wrote at the age of 19, which was lost for 100 years until it was rediscovered by Johannes Brahms, a cantata on the death of the Emperor Joseph. Previously, he'd written pleasant, proficient, but strictly Rococo 18th century style music. And suddenly this huge thing burst out.
Begin your book with an epigraph that is a quote from Beethoven, and it reads, "Power is the morality of outstanding men, and it is my morality too." Now, that strikes me as a sort of surprisingly Machiavellian approach to life.
Machiavellian, you think?
Well, certainly unromantic, or romantic in a slightly sinister way.
That's true. He was not really a romantic. He was a very aggressive and professional career musician. He was by no means a mad genius. He knew exactly what he was about.
That's interesting, since he is almost the very embodiment of our modern idea of, if not mad, the tormented genius.
Yes, yes. But there's a crazy logic behind most of what he did. He was not above playing the mad composer just to have his way. But he was one of the original control freaks. He had to dominate everybody and everything.
His life, his musical life, is not a straight shot. After composing various radical works, he sort of reverts to composing more conservative things. What explains that?
I don't know if I would agree with that. Beethoven was a classicist. All his life, the discipline of the intellect was something that he used to control emotion. He couldn't, like a true romantic, like a Weber or a Mendelssohn or a Schumann, spill out without keeping this intellectual control. But toward the end of his life, he wrote music which was so radical, particularly late string quartets, that they are still radical to this day. As you were saying to me before this program began, you were listening to the Gross Fugue the other day, and the opening note struck you as almost atonal, which they indeed are.
And what did he think of that? I mean, I know what the critics and public of the time were mostly astonished by it and thought it was evidence of his madness. What did he think?
Well, he thought that everything he did was lucid. So Beethoven, to the end of his life, was quite convinced of his own lucidity, his own sanity, and his own perfect control over what he did.
And never really had any doubt about that.
No, I don't think I've ever come across any biographical character with so little self-doubt.
And speaking as the man who's written about Teddy Roosevelt and Ronald Reagan, that's saying a lot.
Yes, I must say Reagan gives Beethoven a run for his money, but I think Beethoven just wins in the confidence stakes.
Evan Morris, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Edmund Morris's book, The Universal Composer, is out right now, and you can find out more about that and Morris's other books at studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson. You have been listening to Studio 360, and I do hope you'll join us again for next week's show. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
Arun Roth,
David Krasnow,
Lital Mulad,
Michelle Siegel,
Ave Carrillo,
Derek John,
Sarah Lilly,
Eric Malinsky,
Caitlin Lindsay,
Amol Mathre,
Katie Grudowski,
Chris Roos.
And our theme music is by David Van Tiegel.
Studio 360 is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I was up at the factory early before the rest of the band, and he had a slew of ads he'd find in these magazines at his doctor's office. And one of the ads had a peelable banana in it. And he said, "How would you like that as an album cover?" I freaked.
The Velvet Underground's John Cale remembers Andy Warhol. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI. It's Sunday.